Konnichiwa, Formula One fans. Since 1987, this Honda track, built next to a theme park, has been a one-of-a-kind circuit for an event that is often the setting of the fight for the championship, the Nihon Grand Prix, the Grand Prix of Japan, which is the 15th round of the season. The Suzuka circuit is a driver favorite and the only figure eight track of the calendar. Starting more technicals, the drivers need to find their rhythm to get through the S's, which will set their pace later down the way for Spoon Curve and 130R. A volcanic eruption and then Typhoon Fan Phone are threatening to blow up this race, like the Mercedes drivers who are each pushing to overtake the other for the championship lead. Nico got by Lewis for pole position, but he has never won here. And Lewis's Japanese win was his rookie year, and that was at the Fuji track, which evens the odds. Either Samurai has a chance to take this battle. But all drivers will face the wet weather conditions and the danger that goes with it. Who will triumph under the storm clouds in the land of the rising sun? And who will lose the way of the warrior? Grill up some yakiniku, pour me some sake, and stay tuned, listeners. This is Desiree, your geisha of F1. And this is your F1 Weekly Japanese Grand Prix Racecast. Sayonara.
There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, Steven, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go with the qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 665, October 10th, 2014. Nasser?
Thank you, sir. Hello to all the F1 Weekly familiar members. Definitely not the weekend we were looking for in the rain in Japan. Back to you, sir.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, we all hope for Jules' recovery and, of course, a big goodbye to Andrea De Cesaris. Nas, welcome to the studio. Of course, we'll have a little Motorsports Mondial. We'll have a little 50 words on the Japanese Grand Prix, and we do have Tech Talk with Tim. Nas, welcome to the studio. Really bad week for Formula One racing, and I mean, everybody's affected by this, especially when you eat, breathe, and think Formula One on a daily basis. It's been brutal.
It has been a very brutal weekend, and it's just, you know, one of those things, Clark. When you thought everything was great, cars are very safe, nothing can go wrong, and we have a terrible situation of all the things under a yellow flag situation. Very, very sad, and it's just terrible what has happened in Japan.
Yes, it's just, you know, and we could put blame anywhere. Why was the race played out so late in the day when they knew that the storm was coming? I mean, everybody knew the timetable. They could have had it earlier in the day. I don't think any of the drivers said that visibility was a problem, but obviously we've had rain in the past. But still, the whole thing seemed to be, you know, something that just, you know, it happened and there's nothing we can do about it. I also agree we shouldn't have any knee-jerk reactions. So, really, to be honest with you, I just want to continue and hope that Jules Bianchi comes out of this coma, because this is a bad situation. Any brain injury is bad.
Yeah, this race was like, you know, the 1973 Indianapolis 500. Just too many things were going on, and then finally we had a couple of fatalities. in that race. And this, you know, like you said, we don't want to be pointing fingers. When things go wrong, they go wrong. I mean, we've seen so many races in far worse conditions, and here it was delayed and then started under a safety car, and it's not a situation where the crash happened at the worst time during the race. You know what I'm saying? It was a yellow flag situation, but really, really terrible. And obviously, like all major tragedies, hopefully there'll be lessons learned, and motor racing cannot afford another accident like this. That's for sure. Not just Formula One.
No, I agree. And I'm sure all of the formulas are looking at this, but just tragic. I mean, so young, you know, a possible seat at Ferrari for this young man, we don't know. A great driver, great family, pedigree, if you might say, history, his father. I mean, this is someone that I would have never thought would have this kind of terrible, terrible tragedy happen to. I mean, it's a mind blower for me.
Oh, yeah, and I got to tell you, Clark, you know, some years ago we started following young drivers because we don't have access to Formula One, and we thought we can, you know, follow some young kids for a few years and hopefully they'll remember us when they get to Formula One. And there were three kids that we met early part of their careers. Jules Bianchi was one of them. Esteban Gutierrez was one of them. Alexander Rossi was one of them. Two of them have made it to Formula One. Rossi, very deservedly, is knocking on the door. And, you know, of all the drivers we have met, Jules Bianchi is the one I met most. You know, I'm friends with the gentleman who was handling his affairs before he got to Formula One, Olivier Menu. Met him so many times, met him in Malaysia, Italy, all over. And even last January when I was at Jerez with Dr. Miguel, Jules came up to me and said hello, and we had a, you know, brief chat. Just a very nice kid and very, very low-key kind of person, you know. No razzmatazz, no hoo-ha. I just feel terrible. This has hit me very hard. You know, I've been following this business for a long time. We've had the severe situation, Gilles Villeneuve, Ronnie Peterson, the Imola thing. But, you know, to be, you know, somewhat, you know, got to know the person. We interviewed him so many times. I'll tell you what happened. Some years ago, I was at the Autosport show in Birmingham, England, and I saw John Surtees walking, and there was a young kid with him. So, of course, for me, meeting John Surtees, only guy to win championship on 2 and 4 wheels, was a big deal. So I walked up to him and, you know, had a brief chat with him. And when I was leaving, I shook hands with the young kid who was with him, Henry Surtees, of course. And he says, you know, thank you, sir. And when his accident happened, even though I met this kid just for a few seconds, I'm having a hard time getting that event and his tragic accident at Brands Hatch out of my mind. And now this has happened. It's just terrible, terrible for everybody.
That's the tragic. You know, we follow these young drivers. You know, we're always positive here at F1 Weekly. We never, even the people we don't like, we're nice to. And when somebody that we follow and always hope that they make it to Formula One, to have something like this, it hits you right in the gut. I mean, it hits you really hard.
And, you know, people who are in our age group, you know, we've been following this for 30, 40 years. I mean, we've seen guys like Graham Hill come and go, their son come and become world champion and go, you know, same situation. So obviously we have a lot of passion. We have a feel for the sport like so many people out there. And it just, you know, what really, it has always, what I've always thought, whether it's Jules Bianchi situation, Schumacher or Sever, you know, these racing professional sports for many, many years, if you want to succeed, you have to walk, talk, eat. Everything is, you know, that sport, whatever your chosen profession is. And when you see these young kids, you know, and I've seen a lot of them over the years, you know, lately I've been following the karting scene also quite a bit. You know, you see them at the age of 8, 10 years, young kid, dreaming of Formula One, sacrificing anything and everything that life has to offer to get to Formula One. And then you have something like this. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
I don't even know what to say.
No, it's devastating. There's nothing we can do. It's brutal. but
also, you know, we're not medical people, so we're not going to speculate on the condition and this and that. But let me, this came on autosport.com today, and some question and answers they had officially from FIA.
Okay.
Shall I read this? And if people want to read all in detail, they can go to autosport.com. And I'm sure other websites have also posted. May I proceed with your consent, sir?
Absolutely.
Okay. First question is what issue you've raised is, was it wrong to start the race at 3 p.m.? And this is what Charlie Whiting had to say. And I quote, firstly, the race start time is not really a matter for the FIA. I warned them that we would not run the race unless it was safe to run it, and there was a high probability that they would not have a race. They said no, they wanted to stick with 3 p.m. start time, but for me, the race start time is totally unconnected to the incident in question. End of quote. Now, the track owner and promoter is, of course, Honda, and the reason they did not want to hold the race earlier at the last minute is that the track is very far away. You know, was built as a testing facility for Honda. So they did not want to have a lot of people show up and find out, oh, the race is already over. And obviously, nobody knew what was going to happen. Your thoughts on not changing the time? I mean, did you have any concerns about that?
Well, I had concerns about it after the race, you know, after everything is over. And, I agree with the track promoters, Honda. You know, you can't start a race 2 hours earlier when you have people driving for hours to get to the track that have paid $300-$500 a ticket. You know, there are limits. I mean, if anything, postpone the race and have it on Monday.
And, you know, they would have never started the race if they felt if there was going to be a serious danger to the drivers.
Of course not. I mean, obviously he doesn't have a crystal ball, and we've seen much worse conditions.
Oh, yeah.
In our lifetime. This was, for me, I thought it was mild. A lot of the drivers were ready to race. I think all the commentary around the Grand Prix was, it's not that bad. I mean, we've seen Fuji 76. We've seen Spa where it's torrential. This is definitely not torrential rain. On the other hand, we are much more leaning towards safety these days than we did even 5 years ago.
Yeah, and talking about Fuji, just look what happened in 2007. How much rain was there?
Exactly. To be honest with you, I was surprised with not having a standing start and starting the race behind the safety car, because I didn't see enough rain to justify starting behind the safety car.
Yeah, and the next question asked was, why did the FIA not bring out the safety car to deal with recovery of Adrian Sutil's car? And this is interesting, and this is what Whiting had to say, and I quote, we put double wave yellows out because we felt the incident could be dealt with without using the safety car. The next stage up is a safety car, but because the car was well away from the track and against the tires, it is the normal procedure for us to follow under those circumstances. We didn't see any need for a safety car, end of quote. You know, I tell you this, I have to say, as much as I love Formula One, my two yens on this issue, they must bring out the safety car in similar conditions in the future, because, you know, we cannot afford a tragedy like this. Again, motorsports is dangerous, even under yellow flag condition. Do you remember what happened when Montoya crashed into that jet dryer?
Yes, exactly.
That was under a yellow flag situation. And, you know, I was, frankly, and I'm being very honest here, I was very surprised before his accident, because, you know, his accident was never shown, and you could not even see the car if there was a second car involved. With that heavy crane there with those big tires, I was saying, you know, there has to be a safety car, because, you know, a car spinning out of control is still traveling at 100 miles per hour is slow for a Formula One car. So that really caught my attention, and I was kind of surprised.
No, I completely agree. And I think these large tractors on these runoff areas have to go. We have to do what they do in Monaco, which is a crane behind the lines that just reaches down and picks it up. Mm-hmm. Without these large vehicles having to actually go on track.
Yeah, you know, it reminded me of my friend, you know, when we used to watch races together, Professor Rubel. He would always say to me, a racing car on the side of the track is a magnet. And that just, you know, there have been accidents, you know, long time ago. Bobby Rahal in sports car racing was racing at Nürburgring, and his car broke down. He walked away, and his car was hit by another car that exploded in flame, and the driver was killed. So, you know, these things have happened, and with the car on the track, and it just, we obviously, what has happened, nobody can change that, unfortunately, but they have to learn from this.
No, I completely agree.
Yeah, and this next question, you know, it's, again, one of those realities of life, but very hard to take and very difficult to read, but I'll do it here. Question was, did Bianchi slow down enough for yellow flags? And this is Whiting's response. I quote, I know what speed he left the track at. We have seen the data from all the cars. A lot of cars came through the double wave yellow sector. Not everyone slowed down as much. There was some that didn't slow down much and some slowed down a lot. And I don't think we need to go into the detail of how much he slowed down relative to the others. Suffice to say, we do have that data. He did slow down, and it is a matter of degree. End of quote. And, you know, we're not going to talk about the details of the accident, but those who have seen, and Dr. Miguel posted a link on F1 Weekly Forum, just to see the impact and have see this crane, which already had Sutil's car on the hook, get lifted quite high after it was hit by Bianchi's Marussia. And I'll tell you, that was heartbreaking. And I remember when the Weldon accident took place, one of the first thing I noticed, the roll bar was missing, and that is always very, very dangerous. And same thing happened here. So just a terrible tragedy, Clark.
It's just awful. I'm just hoping that everything goes well in Russia. Obviously, Marussia is not going to run a second car. And I think this is going to be... you know, and I feel bad for the Russians. It's the inaugural Grand Prix in Sochi, and I think this whole thing is going to put a cloud over this Grand Prix. Everybody's going to be subdued. This is going to affect the rest of the season, even though, you know, we have a great battle between Rosberg and Hamilton. This is just tragic.
Yeah, and, you know, questions that have also been raised, why he was not airlifted, and all sorts of, you know, rumors are flying around. And the chief FIA medical officer, Jean-Charles Piet, he basically referred that the medical center is 15 kilometers from the circuit, which is about 9 miles. The helicopter could take off, but it could not land at the hospital because of the weather condition. So they took him with the ambulance, of course, with a police escort. And I think the... excess time was about 7 minutes, and they don't feel that transfer by ambulance made any difference to Jules' condition.
I think safety came in there as well, and it was raining, it was cloudy. Yeah, let's not cause more any more trouble as it is.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, brutal, and it's sad because there was so much stuff going on with the big news that came out of Red Bull on Friday with Sebastian Vettel handing in his resignation.
Yeah, I mean, that was a real Stuka dive bomb by Sebastian. And, you know, it was interesting. The whole media, the whole Formula One was wrapped up with the McLaren in, you know, waiting for Nando going there, this and that. I mean, this was a complete, unbelievable, the news that came out. And apparently... Sebastian and Christian Horner, Martin Brundle, they were all at dinner, and then Seb left, and Christian Horner gets a text, please come and see me in my room, and then he basically told him, sayonara.
But, yeah, it's interesting how all these things start with a text.
Yeah, yeah. No wonder Vodafone came to Formula One with McLaren.
Thank you.
But it's interesting, you know, Sebastian is leaving the good hands that gave him everything from the age of 12. At Red Bull, his wrong was right. We saw that in Istanbul and Kuala Lumpur. But, you know, nothing is forever, and all good things do come to an end.
Absolutely. I mean, not only that, but after so many years at Red Bull, you do want to try something new and fresh.
Yeah, and Dr. Marco was asked by Ted Kravitz if he feels betrayed by Vettel's decision. He responded by saying he would have felt that way if he was going to Mercedes, but driving for Ferrari, Dr. Marco understands, is a fascination for all drivers. Good for Seb, I guess. And Niki Lauda, being Niki Lauda, who won two world championships with Ferrari, said that Seb will try to do what Schumacher did, and these are Niki's own words, bring success to the spaghetti land again. I think he's no longer interested in spaghetti. That's why he's always referring to spaghetti.
Well, you know what's interesting about that, Seb is not stupid. He having success at Maranello is every F1 driver's dream. It was Fernando's dream.
Oh yeah.
But the problem is Ferrari couldn't deliver. Now see, Seb is young enough to go to Ferrari, and if it takes 5 years and then they're winning again, it might be worth it.
Yes, but I have to say, you know, I am very, very impressed. I never thought, I've said it many times last year, the only person I thought who could rattle his cage was LCH. But now our dingo mate has basically chased him out of the team. This was Sebastian's team.
I know. It's amazing. How do you think Mark Webber feels?
Oh, he's smiling. He's smiling every day.
Yeah, he put another thing on the Barbie.
Absolutely.
No, but you know, I think there's a lot of, and I know we were convinced that Fernando was going to McLaren, but that really hasn't gelled. And I'm thinking, what if Fernando stays at Ferrari and Kimi is gone? Let's face it, where did Kimi start the Japanese Grand Prix?
That is unbelievable. I mean, he's doing worse than Fisico did. I mean, Fisico at least won a couple of races with them and got a pole position or two. And they just did not give him a car that said on the side, this is a winning car. But this Kimi situation is terrible.
Yes. I mean, Kimi Raikkonen is almost a second off Fernando Alonso's time in qualifying. Fernando starts fifth, where Kimi is in 10th. Now, it's not rocket science to figure out that, you know what, Fernando and Sebastian Vettel at Ferrari could be the battle that we were hoping for with Kimi.
Yeah, but, you know, time is going to move on. New blood is coming in. And talking of new blood, Red Bull wasted no time in promoting Daniel Kvyat to the mothership as the teammate to Ricciardo. So that should be interesting. Now, see, when these things happen, you know, you move drivers here and there. Somebody gets exposed pretty soon. So next year we're going to find out how good Daniel Kvyat is. He needs to rattle Ricciardo's cage. Otherwise, you know, the machete falls very quickly at Red Bull.
Yeah, not only that, but, you know, with Carlos Sainz Jr., I think he's about to win the championship at World Series by Renault 3.5, who's a Red Bull boy, who's definitely probably on Toro Rosso's list. All these young drivers keep coming up. Red Bull is, you got to give it to Red Bull. They're doing a great job in young driver development.
Yeah, you know, well, for sure. You know, their thing is, you know, if you're so good, prove it to us, and they throw you to the wolves. You know, hey, Daniel Ricciardo survived, Sebastian Vettel survived. So if you're not surviving, they're going to be, you know, sending you a six-pack of Red Bull and a note saying, have a nice day.
Not only that, but I think Jean-Éric Vergne did a pretty good job. I mean, he out-qualifies Kvyat in the Japanese Grand Prix, does a pretty good job, is quick. I think that was a tough decision. I think they could have gone either way, Kvyat or Vergne. But I think Kvyat did an outstanding job for a 19-year-old. Being Russian, he's going to be the star this weekend. I don't know. Some people are saying it's a big mistake that they just jumped on Kvyat real fast. But, you know, Red Bull, it's an interesting team. They went right out and told everybody right away about Sebastian Vettel. And they didn't want to have that seat empty because, you know, all you get is ridiculousness from the press on who's going to be going to Red Bull. And if they didn't fill that seat with Kvyat, then the rumor mill would have gone rampant about, oh, it could be Fernando, it could be Lewis Hamilton going to Red Bull. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, and they not only made an announcement for their team, they also made an announcement who will be at Ferrari next year. That was interesting.
Well, that was very interesting, and that's the other part I don't understand. That's not confirmed yet. The Spaghetti team takes their time. They're not going to be pushed by Red Bull or Christian Horner, so I found that very, very interesting, and I will laugh if Sebastian goes somewhere else like a German team.
Yeah, you know... I heard this interview a couple of times from different sources when they asked Christian Horner, are you sure he's going to Ferrari? And he said, well, let's put it this way, he's not going to Caterham.
Yeah, but the problem is they're hoping he goes to Ferrari because they know Ferrari will be struggling next year. The last thing they want is Vettel in a Mercedes AMG Petronas.
Absolutely. And you know, talking of Jean-Éric Vannes, he's a tremendous racing talent. I guess he did not meet Red Bull's requirements, and their requirements are pretty simple. He should have done to Daniel Ricciardo what Ricciardo has done to Vettel. That's what they're looking for.
Absolutely.
But you know, there was an interview with Jean-Éric Vannes, and he was asked if he will try to get his seat back at Toro Rosso now that Kvyat is moving, and he responded by saying. And there was a little of, you know, quite a bit of Corsican salt in his answer saying, I think I will race next year in Tour de France. Someone on two wheels.
Yes, I understand. Yes. Good for him. Just don't take any drugs.
That's very true.
Yes. But no. So a completely very strange weekend due to these circumstances. You know, we're not going to go over qualifying and in lap by lap race of the Japanese Grand Prix. Obviously, we know what happened. It's a tragedy. I mean, I think about Bianchi every day right now. It's just it's brutal. It's affected the entire F1 Weekly family.
No, it's terrible, Clark. When I met him first time, it was at Mugello some years ago. I believe it was 2008. And my friend Olivier Meno was handling his affairs. I asked him I knew his grandfather was Mauro Bianchi. And I said, is he here? And he points me to a gentleman. He said, that's him. So I said, can I talk to him for a few minutes? He says, he doesn't speak French, but I'll be happy to, you know, be the interpreter for you. So I had a 5-minute conversation with Mauro Bianchi. And, you know, he used to race. And actually, Mauro won the 1966 Macau Grand Prix. So he was quite a good racer. And then he got badly hurt. And if I recall correctly, his teammate in the 1968 Le Mans was Patrick Depailler. I may have to check on that. But Mauro took over the car, and shortly after leaving the pit, they had forgot to... something went wrong with the brakes. He crashed. Car caught on fire, full of fuel. He was badly burnt. And... his brother, Lucien Bianchi, actually won the race, the same race, 1960 at Le Mans with Pedro Rodriguez in a Ford GT40. And Lucien also made it to Formula One. He actually won races at Watkins Glen, Sebring 12 hours, third in the 1960 at Monaco Grand Prix, and then unfortunately was killed while testing at Le Mans in 1969. So, with Bianchi, like you said, you know, I met his father and mother at Abu Dhabi some years ago and met him many times. And it's just like, it's terrible, man.
It's like it's happened to our family.
Yeah. And, you know, this is something we follow night and day. So like you said, you have no choice but to have this on your mind.
Very, very brutal. So obviously we have to talk about Max Verstappen. He drove an FP1 Friday practice, the first practice Friday morning. Your thoughts, obviously, all eyes were on Max. I'm sure he did a great job. Suzuka is not the easiest track to have your first taste of Formula One, but he's tested the Toro Rosso. You know, he's tested Formula One machinery before, so I didn't see the big deal there. But your thoughts on Max?
Well, you know, Clark... obviously, his papa will say positive things, but facts are facts. You know, according to Yoss, when they put him in a He was testing. He was supposed to go Formula Renault, and you know, one of the Dutch team, Frits van Amersfoort, asked him to, you know, have him try in a F3 car. And according to Jos, he felt more comfortable, and the results were even more impressive in a F3 outing. And people who tested him now, they are saying the same thing about him. And Max's thing is that he was not even, you know, on the limits. And I'm beginning to think, you know, I know it's a tremendous, tremendous comparison, that Dr. Marco's statement that he is a talent like Senna that comes once in decades, it just may be true, you know.
It could be true. I mean,
I will tell you this. There are many drivers who have made it to Formula One and won races. They struggle in their first year in F3 to win more than a race, okay? And you see that in GP2. For this kid to come from karting and this European F3, see, if he was racing in British F3, which is now a shell of what it used to be, with 6-7 cars, it would be another story. But this year's field has Esteban Ocon, Antonio Fuoco, and some other several drivers who've been racing for 2-3 years. For this kid to come and win 6 races in a row, I think total he has won 8 races, that is what you would call an outstanding performance. So it could be a super real deal here that we are looking at.
I agree. No, I just hope he's not being pushed into Formula One too quickly, even though I concur he obviously is extremely talented and could be the next Ayrton Senna. I hate to even say things like that.
Yeah. It's just to a friend of mine, you know, same gentleman, Dr. Rubel, used to say to me when Senna was winning like crazy with Frost as a teammate, he used to say to me, he is too bright of a star, something might happen. And I just hope, you know, we have a safe career for all drivers, including Max. But I got to tell you, his time at Suzuka, 138.157, was only 0.443 of a second from Daniel Kvyat. And afterward, Max said, I was quite relaxed. So we may be seeing a tremendous, tremendous raw talent coming here, as we saw in the qualifying for the 1991 Belgian Grand Prix.
Yes.
That's not a laughing matter. That produced 90-plus Formula One wins.
I understand. And not only that, but that gentleman pretty much ruined Jos Verstappen's career.
Yeah, well, that was Jos Verstappen's bad luck.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Teammates at the wrong time.
Oh, yeah.
Blah, Flavio. Ha. But anyway, no. Interesting, Verstappen. We'll see what happens next year. But I think you're right. I think he'll be qualifying in the top 10 if Toro Rosso stays as competitive as they have been in 2014. I think they've done a great job with the Renault package. So we're going to see what happens. Of course, quickly, it's confirmed Lotus F1 will have the Mercedes package, even though I think they still owe millions to Renault. Mercedes has decided to help these losers out.
Did you call them losers?
They are losers. Have you seen what's happened to Lotus F1? I mean, Kimi won the first race of the season when he was there, and he still hasn't been paid.
Yeah, that is amazing.
It is amazing.
Yeah, that is. But they really, you know, Formula One really needs to work some sort of a compensation package that all the teams that attend all the races, 2 cars every race, they need to take care of their own, you know, system. You know, you have to feed the system.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, but there's still a lot of unanswered questions. Where is Fernando really going? Where is Sebastian Vettel really going? Is Kimi's? I mean, how could Ferrari justify keeping Kimi Raikkonen? And I don't want to hear about contracts. Contracts are absolutely meaningless.
Well, they had a contract when they let him go.
Exactly. Yeah, contracts just mean you have to give him a check.
Yeah.
But we'll see what happens. I mean, I have a hard time justifying Kimi Raikkonen at Ferrari next year when he says nothing, does nothing, and really his performance is stinko. I mean, a Nico Hülkenberg would have done a much better job at Ferrari than Kimi Raikkonen.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think time will probably go by Nico Hülkenberg with all this new talent coming up, you know.
It's sad, but his boat, I think they're pulling up the anchor right now.
Yeah, and you know, motor racing has become, the whole world is so global now. I mean, Mercedes may be German, but you know, hey, if they have LCH available, why not go for him? You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely, but now I hear talk that LCH will be signing for 2015 with Mercedes. So, who knows? I think...
You mean McLaren? That's what the rumor is.
Well, I think he's going to stay at Mercedes.
Yeah, I think so.
I
tell you, man, talking of LCH, he's gone three in a row. I think four in a row is happening this weekend.
It depends. Nico Rosberg, I think what's going to happen is KK has taken him to the woodshed.
And whipped him?
Exactly. Up against the whipping post.
Oh. So he's giving him the max treatment.
Correct.
No, I think, you know, that the talent that is LCH, this is the talent we saw at Mile 7 Renault in 2005 and 2006. And this is what Kimi was when he was at McLaren.
I agree. Yeah. I agree. But Kimi is not what he used to be. See, that's what's different between Fernando. Fernando is pretty consistent year after year after year.
Yeah.
But Kimi gets sleepier and sleepier.
Yeah, it's a strange situation there.
Yeah, but Kimi's a different kind of a guy. You know, he's a partier. You know, even though he's married, I don't think that really helps him at all. But it is what it is. So, you know, any last thoughts on Suzuka? Let's wish Bianchi, the best. The biggest problem is, you know, this is going to be a tragic ending for him and his family. There's nothing we can do, but still, you still have to have some hope.
Yeah, you know, even his father, I think, said in an interview with the French newspaper yesterday or today that, you know, there is no improvement in his situation. We understand it's very serious. But he did say that both mom and dad are very sort of comforted by outpouring of sympathy from all over the world, which, you know, the Michael Schumacher family also went through. Because, you know, racing fans, this is the last thing they want to see. And like you said, I'm hoping against hope, maybe through some miracle. There was some news the other day, I think from Jean Todt, that Michael Schumacher will be able to have a normal life. Obviously, it would be great. Nothing would be better than to see these people get back to normal.
Course
of thing, and hoping against hope, and that's all we can do. But, you know, you asked me about any final thoughts. Yeah, Andre de Cesaris, I mean, the race was not even 24 hours. I go online, and there is Andre de Cesaris killed in a motorcycle accident in Rome. That was very sad. I mean, this, again, is a gentleman who raced for many years in Formula One, had quite a reputation for crashing, this and that. But, you know, played a big part in motor racing, and I remember a lot of his races. He was second to Chico Serra in the 1979 British Formula 3 Championship. You know, back in the day, if you had to prove anything to a Formula 1 team owner, all you had to do was dominate British F3 and you'll be there. And he raced in Formula 2 with Ron Dennis's Project 4. The thing I remember about him most is putting his Alfa Romeo on pole at Long Beach in 1982. And that was, at that time, he was the youngest pole sitter. But then, you know, I think about after 12, 14 laps, he spun out and had a huge accident at, I think it was at Österreichring in a Ligier in 1985, end over end again and again. So pretty sad. He was actually involved in, he was doing a lot of surfing in Hawaii every year. And then half of the season he was involved in currency exchange dealing and all that. But still very sad to see him go out this way on a motorcycle accident.
Oh, terrible. Absolutely terrible. He was in Formula One from 1980 to 94. Like you said, he drove for a lot of teams. Alfa Romeo, McLaren, Ligier, Minardi, Brabham, Real, Scuderia Italia, Jordan, Tyrrell, and Sauber.
Yeah, and talking of Jordan, it was actually the race. He was teammate to Schumacher when Schumacher made his debut. And the Cesaris came pretty close to winning that race. He was closing in on Senna in his 7-up Jordan. when he had a, you know, engine kablamo or some sort of technical gizmachi.
Yeah, the old gizmachi always gets you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, it was just a bad week. That's all it is. You know, I think we'll start fresh in Russia, which is this weekend. And, of course, this podcast will get published probably after the Russian Grand Prix because we are so busy here at F1 Weekly. But, nevertheless, it is what it is. We'll see what happens. Your thoughts on Sochi?
Well, the track looks very good. I've seen a little bit of action in practice, and LCH is on a hot Russian roll. So, and of course, you know, I hate politics and sports, but, you know, again, it's part of life, I guess. Like you said, we need to start fresh. Hope we have a great, safe race. And I would like to see four in a row for LCH.
Yeah. I'd like to see Fernando Alonso win.
Well, you've been predicting a win for him since the season started.
So? But his girlfriend's Russian.
Oh, yes.
So you know what that means.
Tell me.
It's scripted. Oh. Putin, she calls Putin. Putin sets everybody straight. Fernando wins. Everybody's happy.
Yes.
Because, it, you know, if Fernando wins, it doesn't screw with the championship.
Yeah.
It just keeps people happy.
Yeah, Ferrari victory is always a great thing. And Nando, man, the guy is just an incredible racing talent. And I would like to see him win a race this year.
Yeah, so would I. So would I. But it just doesn't seem to want to happen, at least for some of us. But still, no, I'm hoping for a great Grand Prix. Like I said, I think there will be a cloud over the entire atmosphere of the weekend. But it is what it is. Hopefully, maybe we'll get some good news and that'll cheer everybody up. I don't know. It's been brutal. You know, maybe a Formula One race is just what we need to get us back into form. I'm looking forward to it. Back-to-back races are pretty tough for us these days because of our separation.
Oh, my goodness. And, you know, hopefully we can cheer our listeners with this conversation I had with Indian racer Jahan Daruwala, who some years ago won the British Karting Championship. He's a pretty good racing talent from India, from Mumbai, previously known as Bombay. So I hope people enjoy this brief chat with Mr. Jahan Daruwala. What say you, sir?
I wish I could pronounce his name, but thanks for speaking with F1Weekly.com.
Okay, folks, I'm here in Oschersleben, Germany, with a young Indian talent, Jahan Daruwala. Jahan, welcome to F1 Weekly. How are you today?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Very good, sir. Thanks. Now, you were part of the One in a Billion driver search from India. Give us a little background of how that search went and how many people were involved.
I mean, there were many drivers who took part. There were more than 2,000. And out of them, they only chose 100 in the first few. And I was one of those 100 to begin with. And they shortlisted those to 10 and then to 3. And out of those 3, we did a whole championship in Britain last year. And then I was chosen as the only one.
I was talking to your dad earlier. He said he did not have any interest. How did you interest in racing? How did you pick up interest in motorsports?
I mean, since I was a kid, I used to watch Formula One on TV. And I love Fernando Alonso. And since then, I've always been interested in racing.
How big is karting scene in India? I know there are quite a few drivers from India past several years, but in terms of facilities and opportunities, what's the scene?
I mean, it's a bit different because it's not as much, you don't spend as much money there, so there's a lot less drivers because they can't really afford it. So each class is only 12 to 15 maximum, and there's only one championship with 5 rounds in it, so it's a lot different year. We do about 25 races a year over here and spend most of our life racing.
You like that kind of life?
Yeah, love it.
Okay, now, how much racing did you do in India before you came over to England?
I did 2 years in India, and then I started racing in Asia for another year. So I did my first 3 years of karting just in Asia, and then I moved to England in 2012 for the first time.
Now, we've had two Indian drivers in Grand Prix racing, Naren Karthikeyan and also Karun Chandok. Have you ever talked to them about advice in racing, or have they given you any guidance?
I mean, I've met both of them, and they both seem like nice people, and they say the way I'm going, it all looks good for me to go in F1 one day.
How big was the difference in terms of depth of competition between racing in India and racing in England?
I mean, it's a massive difference, because when I used to race in India, I was always at the front. And then when I came to England, the conditions, the track, everything was really different. So I started off midfield, and then over a year I progressed and then won the last race of the championship.
You won the British karting championship, right?
Yeah, I did win it last year. It was a really hard battle between my teammates, Ina Mohammed, Daniel Tickham and me, and over the end of the year I managed to win it.
Okay. What were some of your best races?
My best race was this year in Castelletto. It was just my fifth race in senior karting, and I won both the funds, and it was my best moment so far.
You're in KF2 now. Is the talent pool in KF2 much stronger than in KF3?
I mean, the quality of drivers are pretty similar, but the experience of drivers racing you're racing against is a lot different, because they've been racing in KF2 for a lot of time and they know exactly what to do, so just racing against them is a big deal.
Are you doing some races in India also?
Not anymore, nothing, just two in Europe now.
Now, I'm sure you've met Dr. Vijay Mallya. What kind of character he is?
I mean, he's a great man. He's really interested in motorsport, and he's keen for the team to do well. And he's supported me really well by bringing me to this great team. And all of now, it's all been pretty good. He's a great man to talk with and to deal with, so it's been all good so far.
Now, I was watching a video on a TV program also about the Force India karting program. Terry Fullerton, who's a karting legend, was involved, and Nico Hulkenberg was also at one of the test sessions. How much help have these two people been to you in learning the racing scene in Europe?
Terry Fullerton has been a huge help to me, because he's the one who brought me from being mid-grid to a front runner, both in the wet and the dry. And his just coaching experience has been huge for me, and that's one of the main reasons I'm here right now. And Nico Hulkenberg was one of the judges in a 1 in a billion program, and he saw me and he picked me.
What is the game plan for Mr. Jahan Daruvala next year?
I mean, I'm not sure as of now. I think I may do another year of karts or Formula karts next year.
If you do another season of karting, you think it's going to help you when you get to single-seater racing?
Yeah, I think doing another year, there's no harm. It's just more experience, and the race stuff improves a lot, and it should help for cars if I go ahead.
What's your favorite karting track in Europe?
Sarno. It's a track in Italy. Mm-hmm. And it's got all sorts of corners, and since I went there, I'm always fast. I was second in the World Championships last year, and I qualified on pole this year in the WSK.
Okay, you mentioned Fernando Alonso is your hero. What was the first Formula One race you went to, and what was your first impression of the cars and the sound?
My first Formula One race I went to was the first race in Singapore, and it was the first race in the night, so it was a great pleasure to be there. It was just unbelievable, the experience. Just the cars braking, the amount of force goes onto the front tyres, and it was just a great experience. It just got me more into the sport.
Are you as good in school as you are on the track?
Yeah, I would say so.
What's your favorite subject in school?
Mathematics.
Cool. Okay, Formula One, very new look this year, coming down to championship, coming down to between two drivers. Your take on the new cars and how they sound, and who do you think will be world champion?
I mean, it's a whole different era of a Formula One. The sound as people gotten used to, and it's not that great, but still, the racing and the cars are a lot better this year, because people drive close to each other and are able to pass a lot easier. And I think it's gonna be a tough championship, and whoever holds the nerve at the end is probably gonna win it.
Do you have any preference?
Lewis Hamilton.
Cool. Okay, great talking to you. Finally, how about a message to listeners of our podcast, and please tell them about your website also.
I mean, I currently don't have a website on me, but...
You're from India and you don't have a website?
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it?
Okay. How about a message for our listeners?
I mean, it's been a great career for me so far. And support from the crowd and people around me should boost me forward. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
And now, here's Tech Talk with Tim.
Greetings, listeners, for a special edition of Tech Talk. Tonight, it's Track Talk with Tim, where I focus on the exciting intricacies of a specific part of the Formula One world. Tech junkies, don't worry. This edition will be plenty technical for you, too. It won't be long before the F1 circus moseys on down to Texas, and Circuit of the Americas is one tilkadrome I really like to discuss. In particular, I think Turn 1 is, as the locals might say, fine as frog's fur. Do yourself a favor and look up Turn 1. I recommend you use a maps program, but you can also Google it. But you really need to see this turn from a bird's eye view to understand what makes it so interesting. In case you're having trouble finding it, Turn 1 is the southernmost point on the track. Sure, this turn is special because it's uphill and it's the first turn in the race, but there's something extra special going on. The track width. Unlike most turns, where the width of the track stays pretty constant, Turn 1 gets fat right before the apex, then thinner again. More specifically, while the outside of the turn has a pretty typical shape, the inside edge looks as though it's providing an extra lane, like a shortcut to the apex of the turn. It's subtle, but very intentional. What is this all about? First, let's talk a little bit about normal race strategy. By now, most of you are familiar with what's called the racing line. The racing line is the path around the track that provides the quickest lap time. The fact that cars try to follow this line at nearly all times is evidenced by the concentration of tire marks along it and the lack of marbles thrown off by degrading tires. When following the racing line, cars enter a turn from the outside, move inward around the apex, and then move back outward at the turn exit. This path is actually a few meters longer than simply hugging the inside edge of the turn, but because starting and ending a turn at the outside edge allows cars to maintain a higher speed through the turn and exit with more speed to head towards the next one, it's a faster path. It's the same thing in baseball. Hitters round the bases when they attempt doubles, triples, and inside the park home runs. Although the shortest path around the bases is to run directly from one base to the next and stop and turn sharply at 90 degrees, slowing down enough to make this turn really slows down a base runner. So, in theory, a competitive car on the racing line shouldn't be able to be overtaken. And historically, this has been a problem in Formula One. Differences in tire life, DRS, KERS, pit strategy, etc. have tried to make overtaking easier, but overtaking is still rare in F1 because if a driver attempts an overtake, it means leaving the racing line and taking a slower lap around the track. There's more to it, though. As I said before, the racing line is the path around the track that provides the quickest lap time. But overtaking isn't about driving a quick lap around the entire track. It's about surging in front of your opponent at one specific location. This may sound confusing, but looking at Turn 1 will help you understand. The racing line for Turn 1 starts on the outside of the curve, with a car braking before it begins to turn. That's very typical. Meanwhile, a car on the shortcut lane heads into the turn and brakes much later. Since it has been able to travel in a straight line, it hasn't needed to start turning yet. At this point, the turn quickly narrows and the car finds itself no longer able to hug the inside lane, but instead it moves rapidly to the outside edge of the track, braking along the way. Try to visualize this as you look at the turn from above. In order to stay on the road, the car must be moving relatively slowly at the point it crosses the track. This awkward braking will cost the car lap time, but it has established something important. The car taking the shortcut line has arrived at the apex more quickly, and it has cut across the track from inside to outside, precisely as the car taking the racing line would like to be there. It doesn't matter that the car that took the shortcut line is now moving extremely slowly. It has cut off the car on the racing line, and its opponent will need to brake to avoid a collision. That makes the overtake stick. Overtaking isn't about driving the fastest possible lap. It's about being faster at one specific location. And in this case, it's all about being the first to the apex of turn one. In conclusion, turn one is all about setting up a conflict of interests. Driving the racing line means getting around the track as quickly as possible, but this opens you up to being cut off at turn one. Using the shortcut line of turn one every lap means losing time every lap, but getting enough of a boost where it counts to overtake an opponent and forcing them to brake where they wouldn't normally is the benefit of using the shortcut line when you need to. As always, please send feedback to info@f1weekly.com, or you can contact me directly on the forums. My new name there is Tech Tim. I'd be happy to discuss ideas for new episodes or hear what you felt about this or previous episodes. And I'm looking forward to seeing a bunch of you in person at Austin. Cheers.
Tim, keep up the good work. Another zero on your paycheck. And now let's go to the F1 Weekly Forum for 50 words on the Japanese Grand Prix. Kehei Sin writes, "We start with rain and a safety car and finish as we started. Button looked all set for a good day at the races, having made the correct tire change at the right time. But in the end, it's business as usual for the German team. Hamilton passes Rosberg on the track this time, but Rosberg could justifiably justify himself by saying he didn't have the right setup of the day." Leon Bray, "The weather deals out some interesting racing. Lewis demonstrates that he is numero uno, and Danny shows everyone how to overtake. Jenson Button demonstrates why he should be the McLaren strategist, and Brundle predicts an accident involving a recovery vehicle. Good racing throughout the field, could have been better television coverage. Hope Bianchi is okay." Dr. Mark F., "Wonderful performances from the usual Rainmaster suspects, with some excellent overtakes and massive concentration shown by all. Martin Brundle's experience proves awfully prescient as poor Jules hits a trackside recovery vehicle. Our thoughts are with him at this time." Philip Pegler, "A day to forget in Formula One. Thoughts are prayers are with the Bianchi family and the family of former driver Andrea De Gutierrez. Congratulations to Lewis Hamilton, although that hardly seems important at the time." And finally, from Neon Zapper, "The rain and the accidents made this year's Suzuka Grand Prix bittersweet. Seb was feeling motivated, and the electrical gremlins jumped from Merck to Ferrari. Aside from the hospitalization of Jules, this was another outstanding race on the 2014 calendar." So there you have it. Nass, any final thoughts?
No, sir. Just hope everybody is doing well in the F1 Weekly Familia. Season is coming to an end. Of course, it'll be a bittersweet season. And I'm hoping to get some more tech tips from Tim, our man Tim, when we get together in Texas.
Exactly. So I hope you enjoy that. And certainly it's sad that this wonderful season that started off with terrible-sounding motors, everybody complaining, now it's going to go down to the wire, I think. And it's too bad that the season will be tainted by this tragedy. But it is what it is, and we still have four races to go. So there you have it. Go, Fernando. I want to thank all the listeners. Good night.
Bye-bye.